So this evening, I'll be doing another reading from Lungpa Cha. This is from his The Collected Teachings of Ajahn Chah, Volume 3. It's a rather infamous talk entitled Toilets on the Path. And I'll start off by reading the introduction by Ajahn Jayasaro. The following talk was originally given in the Lao language and translated into Central Thai for Lungpa Cha's biography, Upalamani. It's a very powerful talk, and why I was particularly keen to include this in the Thai biography and a certain amount of it in the New English version is that nothing quite like it exists in English translation. Most of the work that has been done has focused on the meditation and wisdom teachings. In fact, the daily life at Wat Pa Pong, those types of Dhamma talks were really quite infrequent and very much treasured when they were given. But the daily kind of instruction and most of the talks were on what we call Kor Wat, monastic regulations, emphasizing the Sila side of practice. Part of that probably has to do with the fact that forest monasteries, particularly Ajahn Chah monasteries 20 years ago, were of a very different composition, a different nature from how they are these days because of the large number of novices then. Then teenage novices would tend to be very energetic and boisterous and would affect the atmosphere of the monastery quite significantly, as you can imagine. That's the reason why work projects were so predominant in monasteries in those days. Abbots had the problem of trying to administer a community in which as many as half of the members weren't that interested in being monastics. Monks of my generation have a lot of stories of naughty novices, difficult, obstreperous, and obnoxious novices. Although at Wat Pa Pong the percentage of novices was somewhat less, irony not intended. Although at Wat Pa Pong the percentage of novices was somewhat less, they did have an influence. Together with temporarily ordained monks, or monks who were hanging out not really knowing why they were there, ordaining as a gesture to show gratitude to their parents. I was surprised when I first went to Wat Pa Pong because I was expecting a boot camp, a really tough kind of monastery. Certainly there was that, but what surprised me was the number of monks and novices who didn't seem to appreciate what was going on and weren't that committed to the training Ajahn Chah was giving. This meant that many of the talks that were given stressed Kor Wat Pratipada, rather than being refined talks on the nature of samadhi and jhana, etc. The kind of rhythm you would find in monasteries, whether it was Wat Pa Pong or a branch, was that you would have a storming desana that would blow everyone over and leave people shaking. Then things would be really strict for a few days. Then it would gradually deteriorate until one or two things happened that were really gross, and you knew that there would be one of those rousing desanas. So you would then brace yourself. Then the same pattern would start again. Ajahn Chah gave the strongest and best of this particular genre of monastic discourse. This talk is particularly strong. What's remarkable about it is that it wasn't given in his so-called early days, in his 40s or 50s, when he was still very vigorous and strong, but actually towards the end of his teaching career, when the abiding image of Ajahn Chah among Western monks was of this grandfatherly figure. But that was very much a simplification. The kind of Ajahn Chah you see in the photographs and books, smiling and kind, was certainly one Ajahn Chah, but it was not the whole story. I think this talk gives quite a good impression of that. It's very difficult to render the tone of one of these talks. With Dhamma talks, there is the content of what's being said, but there are also all sorts of nonverbal things going on, as well as the whole background of the relationship between a teacher and his students. This is something, of course, which doesn't appear in print. For someone who has never lived in a forest monastery with a Kruba Ajahn, when they listen to one of these talks, it can seem to be a rather hectoring and bullying kind of talk, over the top and a bit too much. So you really have to try to put yourself in that position of living in a forest monastery where things are really starting to go downhill, and it's time for the teacher to get people back on track. Toilets on the Path. There isn't much work that needs to be done at the moment, apart from Ajahn Liam's project out at the dyeing shed. When it's finished, washing and dyeing robes will be more convenient. When he goes out to work, I'd like everyone to go and give him a hand. Once the new dyeing shed is finished, there won't be much else to do. It will be time to get back to our practice of the observances to the basic monastic regimen. Bring these observances up to scratch. If you don't, it's going to be a real disaster. These days of practice of the observances related to lodgings, the Senasanavata, is particularly dreadful. I'm beginning to doubt whether or not you know what these words, Senasanavata, means. Don't just turn a blind eye to the state of the kutis that you live in and the toilets that you use. Lay people from Bangkok, Ayutthaya, all over the country offer funds for our needs. Some send money in the post for the monastery kitchen. We are monastics. Think about that. Don't come to the monastery and become more selfish than you were in the world. That would be a disgrace. Reflect closely on the things that you make use of every day, the four requisites of robes, alms food, dwelling place, and medicines. If you don't pay attention to your use of these requisites, you won't make it as a monk. The situation with regard to dwelling places is especially bad. The kutis are in a dreadful state. It's hard to tell which ones have got monks living in them and which are empty. There are termites crawling up the concrete posts and nobody does anything about it. It's a real disgrace. Soon after I came back, I went on an inspection tour and it was heartrending. I feel sorry for the lay people who built these kutis for you to live in. All you want to do is wander around with your bowls and gluts over your shoulders looking for places to meditate. You don't have a clue how to look after this kutis and sangha property. It's shocking. Have some consideration for the feelings of the donors. On my inspection tour, I saw pieces of cloth that had been used in the kutis and then thrown away, still in good condition. There were spittoons that had been used but not properly stored. In some places, people had pissed in them and then not tipped the urine away. It was really disgusting. Even lay people don't do that. If you practitioners of Dhamma can't even manage to empty spittoons, then what hope is there for you in this life? People bring brand new toilet bowls to offer. I don't know whether you even ever clean them or not, but there are rats going in the toilets to shit, and geckos. Rats, geckos, and monks, all using the place together. The geckos never sweep the place out, and neither do the monks. You're on the same level as they are. Ignorance is no excuse with something like this. Everything you use in this life are supports for the practice. Venerable Sariputta kept whatever he lived in immaculately clean. If he found somewhere dirty, he would sweep it with a broom. If it was during alms round, he'd use his foot. The living place of a true practice monk is different from that of an ordinary person. If your kutti is an utter mess, then your mind will be the same. This is a forest wat. In the rainy season, branches and leaves fall to the ground. In the afternoon, before sweeping, collect the dead branches in a pile and drag them well into the forest. Sweep the borders of the paths completely clean. If you're sloppy and just work and sweep in the perfunctory way, then the kutis and paths will be completely ruined. At one time, I made walking meditation paths to separate the paths leading to the kutis. Each kuti had its own individual path. Everyone came out from the kuti alone except for the people out of the back. You'd walk straight to and from your own kuti so that you could look after your own path. The kutis were clean and neat. These days, it's not like that. I invite you to take a walk up to the top of the monastery and see the work I've been doing on the kuti and surrounding area, as an example. As for repairing the kutis, don't put a lot of work into repairing things that don't need to be repaired. These are dwellings of the sangha, which the sangha has allotted to you. It's not right to make any changes to them that take your fancy. You should ask permission or consult with the senior monk first. Some people don't realize what is involved and overestimate themselves. They think they are going to make an improvement, but when they get down to it, they make something ugly and awkward. Some people are just plain ignorant. They take hammers and start banging nails into hardwood walls, and before they know it, they've destroyed the wall. I don't know who it is, because as soon as they've done it, the culprits run away. When someone else moves in, it looks awful. Carefully consider the link between a clean, orderly, and pleasing dwelling place and meditation practice. If there's lust or aversion in your mind, try to concentrate on that. Hone in on it. meditate on it. Wear any of the defilements right where they occur. Do you know what looks pleasing and what doesn't? If you're trying to make out that you don't, it's a disgrace and you're in for a hard time. Things will just get worse day by day. Spare a thought for the people who came from every province in the country to see this wat. The dwelling of a Dhamma practitioner isn't large. It's small but clean. If a noble one leaves a low-lying area, then it becomes a cool and pleasant land. If he goes to live up in the uplands, then those uplands become cool and pleasant. Why should that be? Listen to this well. It's because his heart is pure. He doesn't follow his mind. He follows Dhamma. He is always aware of his state of mind. But it's difficult to get to that stage. During sweeping periods, I tell you to sweep inwards towards the middle of the path, and you don't do it. I have to stand there and shout, "Inwards! Inwards!" Or is it because you don't know what inwards means that you don't do it? Perhaps you don't. Perhaps you've been like this since you were kids. I've come up with quite a few theories. When I was a child, I'd walk past people's houses and often hear parents tell their kids to shit well away from the house. Nobody ever did. As soon as they were just a small distance from the house, that would be it. Then when the stink got bad, everyone would complain. It's the same kind of thing. Some people just don't understand what they're doing. They don't follow things all the way through to their conclusion. Either that, or else they know what needs to be done, but they're too lazy to do it. It's the same with meditation. There are some people who don't know what to do, and as soon as you explain it to them, they do it well. But there are others who, even after it has been explained to them, they still don't do it. They've made up their minds not to. Really consider what the training of the mind consists of for a monk. Distinguish yourselves from the monks and novices that don't practice. Be different from lay people. Go away and reflect on what that means. It's not as easy as you seem to think. And you ask questions about meditation, the peaceful mind, and the path all the way to Nibbana, but you don't know how to keep the path of your kuti and how to keep clean the path to your kuti and toilet. It's really awful. If you carry on like this, then things are going to steadily deteriorate. The observances that the Buddha laid down regarding the dwelling place are concerned with keeping it clean. A toilet is included amongst the sannyasana. In fact, it is considered to be a very small kuti and shouldn't be left dirty or slovenly. Follow the Buddha's injunction and make it a pleasant place to use so that whichever way you look, there's nothing offensive to the eye. Ow! That little novice over there. Why are you yawning already? It's still early in the evening. Are you usually asleep by this time or what? Nodding backwards and forwards, there as if you're on the point of death. What's wrong with you? The moment you have to listen to a talk, you get groggy. You're never like this at the mealtime, I notice. If you don't pay any attention, then what benefit are you going to get from being here? How are you ever going to improve yourself? Someone who doesn't practice is just a burden on the monastery. When he lives with a teacher, he is just a burden on the teacher, creating difficulties and giving him a heavy heart. If you're going to stay here, then make a go of it. Or do you think you can just play around at being a monk? Take things to their limit. Dig down until you reach bedrock. If you don't practice, things won't just get better by themselves. People from all over the country send money for the kitchen to see your needs. And what do? You leave the toilets dirty and your kutis unswept. What's this all about? Put things away. Look after them. You're pissing into the spittoons and leaving them right where you use them. If you have a mosquito net you don't like, you just throw it away. If the lay people were to see that, they would be disheartened. However poor we are, whatever the hardships might be, we still manage to buy some cloth to offer for the monks. They're living like kings, really good cloth without a single tear in it thrown away all over the place. They would lose all their faith. You don't have to give Dhamma talks to proclaim the teachings. When lay people come and they see that the monastery is clean and beautiful, they know that the monks here are diligent and know their observances. You don't have to flatter or make a fuss of them. When they see the kutis and the toilets, they know what kind of monks live in the wat. Keeping things clean is one part of proclaiming Buddhism. While I was a young novice at Wat Bangor, a vihara that was built and they bought over a hundred spittoons for it. On the annual Pravisandra Nan, when there was a lot of visiting monks, the spittoons were used as receptacles for betel juice. Remember, this Nan is a festival of merit-making to commemorate the last life of the Bodhisattva himself. And yet, when it was over, the dirty spittoons would just be stashed away in odd corners of the hall. 100 spittoons, every one of them full of betel juice, and none of them were emptied. I came across the spittoons and I thought, if this is not evil, then nothing is. They filled them with betel juice and left them there until the next year. Then they'd pull them out, scrape off enough of the dried crud to make them recognizable as spittoons, and start spitting in them again. That's the kind of karma that you get reborn in, that gets you reborn in hell. Absolutely unacceptable. Monks and novices who act like that lack any sense of good and bad, long and short, right and wrong. They are acting in a lazy and shiftless way, assuming that as monks and novices they can take things easy, and without realizing it, they turn into dogs. Have you seen them? The old people with gray hair who pay homage to you as they lift up their bamboo containers to put rice in your bowl? When they come here to offer food, they bow and bow again. Take a look at yourself. That's what made me leave the village monastery. The old people coming to offer food and bowing over and over again. I sat thinking about it. What's so good about me that people should keep bowing to me so much? Wherever I go, people raise their heads in Anjali. Why is that? In what way am I worthy of it? As I thought about it, I felt ashamed to face my lay supporters. It wasn't right. If you don't think about this and do something about it right now, then when will you? You've got a good opportunity and you're not taking it. Look into this matter if you don't believe me. Really think it over. I've mentioned Chao Kuo Nor of Wat Tepsirin in discourses before. During the reign of King Vajiravud, he was a royal page. When the king died in 1925, he became a monk. The only time he ever left his kuti was for formal meetings of the Sangha. He wouldn't even go downstairs to receive lay guests. He lived in his kuti together with a coffin. During his entire monastic life, he never went on tudong. He didn't need to. He was unshakable. You go on tudong until your skin blisters. You go up mountains and then down to the sea, and once you get there, you don't know where to go next. You go blindly searching for nibbana when with your mind in a muddle, sticking your nose in every place you can, and wherever you go, you leave dirty toilets behind you, too busy looking for nibbana to clean them. Are you blind or what? I find it amazing. There's a lot more to enlightenment and nibbana than that. The first thing is to look after your dwelling place. Well, it isn't necessary to compel everyone to do this, or what? Is it necessary to compel everyone to do this, or what? If you're not really stubborn and recalcitrant, then it shouldn't have to go that far. At the moment, the people who do take care of things work themselves half dead. The ones who couldn't care less remain indifferent. They don't look, they don't pay any attention, they haven't a clue. What's to be done with people like that? The problems that come up with the requisites of dwellings, alms food, robes, are like green head flies. You can drive them off for a while, but after they've buzzed around for a bit, they come back and land in the same place. These days, a lot of you are leaving the equivalent of one or two plates of leftovers each. I don't know why you take such a huge amount of food. One lump of sticky rice is enough to fill your belly. Just take a sufficient amount. You take more than you can eat, and then tip away what's left to go rotten in the pit. These days there's about a dozen big bowls of leftover food. I think it's shameful that you don't know the capacity of your own stomach. Only take as much as you can eat. What's the point of taking any more than that? If your leftovers are enough to furnish three or four lay people's breakfast and more, then it's too much. How is someone who has no sense of moderation going to understand how to train his mind? When you're practicing sitting meditation and your mind's in a turmoil, where are you going to find the wisdom to pacify it? If you don't know If you don't even know basic things like how much food you need, what it means to take little, that's really dire. If you don't know your limitations, you'll be like the greedy fellow in the story who tried to catch a big log of wood out of the forest that he fell down dead from its weight. Bhojanamattanyuta means moderation in the consumption of food. Jagarinyanu yoga means putting forth effort without indulging in the pleasure of rest. Indriya sangvara means restraining the eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, and mind in order to prevent thoughts of satisfaction and dissatisfaction from arising. These practices have all gone out the window. It's as if you got no eyes, no ears, and no mouth. I don't know what kind of hungry ghost that makes you. You don't sweep your lodging. Chickens are the only animals I know of who eat and then make a mess where they're standing. When you don't understand what you're doing, the more you practice, the more you decline. You're looking more and more gluttonous all the time. Know your limits. Look at the time when we were building the boat, and some coffee was brought over. I heard some people complaining, "Oh, enough, enough. I've had so much, I feel sick." That's an utterly disgusting thing for a monk to say, drinking so much that you feel like vomiting. 7 or 8 cups each. What are you thinking of? It's taking things too far. Do you think you become monastics in order to eat and drink? If it was some kind of competition, it was an insane one. After you'd finished, the cups were left out in a long line, and so were the kettles. Nobody did any washing up. Only dogs don't clean up after they've eaten. What I'm saying is that if you were real monks and novices, the kettles would have been washed. This kind of behavior points to all kinds of unwholesome habits inside you. Whenever someone acts like that goes, wherever someone like who acts like that goes, he takes his mediocrity with him. I'm saying all of this as food for thought. Really look at how you're living these days. Can you see anything that needs improving? If you carry on as you are now, the monks who are really dedicated to practice won't be able to endure it. They'll all leave, or if they don't, the ones that stay won't want to speak to you, and the Wat will suffer. When the Buddha entered Nibbana, he didn't take the ways of practice along with him, you know. He left them here for all of us. There's no need to complicate matters by talking about anything too far away from us. Just concentrate on the things that can be seen here, the things we do every day. Learn how to live together in harmony and help each other out. Know what's right and what's wrong. Garavo cha nivato cha santuti cha katanyuta. This subject of respect needs to be understood. And that's from the Mangala Sutta. It means to be reverent and humble, content and grateful. This subject of respect needs to be understood. Nowadays, things have gone far beyond what's acceptable. I'm the only one many of you show any deference to. It's not good for you to be like that. It's not good to be afraid of me. The best thing is to venerate the Buddha. If you only do good because you're afraid of the teacher, then it's hopeless. You must be fearful of error, revere the Dhamma that the Buddha taught, and be in awe of the power of the Dhamma, which is our refuge. The Buddha taught us to be content and of few wishes, restrained and composed. Don't get ahead of yourself. Look at what's near to hand. Lay people think that the Sangha of Wat Pa Pong practices well, and they send money to the kitchen to buy food. You take it for granted. But sometimes when I sit and think about it, and I'm criticizing the bhikkhus and novices who aren't practicing here, not those that do, I feel ashamed to consider that things aren't as they think. It's like two oxen pulling a cart. The clever one gets harnessed right in front of the yoke and leaves the other one to struggle up front. The ox near the yoke can go all day without getting tired. It can keep going or it can take a rest. It can do whatever it likes because it's not taking any weight. It's not expending any energy. With one ox pulling it, the cart moves slowly. The ox at the back enjoys its unfair advantage. Supatthipanno, one who practices well. Ujjupatthipanno, one who practices with integrity. Nyayapatthipanno, one who practices to truly abandon defilements. Sammicchapatthipanno, one who practices with great correctness. Read those words frequently. They are the virtues of the Sangha, the virtues of monks, the virtues of novices, the virtues of pakals, the virtues of practitioners. In my opinion, you do well to leave the world to practice in this way. The villagers that come to pay their respects have so much faith in you that at the start of the green rice season they don't let their family have any rice. The first of the crop is put aside for the Sangha. At the start of the mango season, the children don't get to eat the big mangoes. Their parents ripen them up and keep them for the monks. When I was a child, I'd get angry at my mother and father for that. I couldn't see why they had so much faith. They didn't know what went on in the monastery. But I'd often see the novices sneaking an evening meal. And if that's not bad karma, then what is? Speaking and acting in various unwholesome ways, and then having people offer you food. That's karma that will take you deeper than the deepest hell realm. What good can come of it? Really think about this well. Right now, your practice is a mess. Disseminating Buddhism isn't just a matter of expounding on Dhamma. It's a matter of reducing wants, being content, keeping your dwelling clean. So what's going on? Every time someone goes into the toilet, he has to hold his nose up to the roof. It smells so bad, nobody dares to take a full breath of air. What are you going to do about that? It's not difficult to see what your problem is. It's obvious as soon as you see the state of the toilet. Try it out. Make this a good monastery. Making it good doesn't require so much. Do what needs to be done. Look after the kutis and the central area of the monastery. If you do, lay people who come in and see it may feel so inspired by religious emotion that they realize the Dhamma here, then, and there and then. Don't you have any sympathy for them? Think of how it was when you enter a mountain or a cave, how that feeling of religious emotion arises and the mind naturally inclines towards Dhamma. If people walk in and all they see are monks and novices with unkempt demeanor, living in ill-kept kutis and using ill-kept toilets, where is the religious emotion going to arise from? When wise people listen to someone talking, they know straight away what's what. A single glance is enough for them. When someone starts speaking, the sages know right away whether he is a selfish person accumulating defilements, whether he has views in conflict with the Dhamma or the discipline, or if he knows the Dhamma. If you've already practiced and been through these things, they're plain to see. You don't have to do anything original. Just do the traditional things. Revive the old practices that have declined. If you allow the degeneration to continue like this, then everything will fall apart, and you'll be unable to restore the old standards. So make a firm determination with your practice, both the external and internal. Don't be deceitful. Monks and novices should be harmonious and do everything in unity. And it's a pretty long talk, but I can stop there.
The amount of food that a lay person would have for breakfast, and how much would that? Because American breakfast is
is this the Kansas breakfast? It's the California one. I think just that. It was really sweet one time. Period of practice when it was before Rinpoche. It must have been in June, around his birthday, because Lopa was still alive, and that's when we would have like Sangha meetings, and that would be sort of all the branch monasteries would come, and we'd have a period of just a day or two or a few days. I can't remember what it was, but we'd have practice, and it was a few days, I think, over Rinpoche's birthday. And a lot of it was just to kind of revisit and reestablish proper standards in the monasteries and reinvigorate the actual sort of meditation practices. So there would be group meditation and Dhamma talks, and then, but then we'd also, one of the things I remember that day that we were doing was when we finished the meal, then we'd wait to get up before going to wash our bowls, and then a few of the ajahns would go down the line and open up the bowls to going along and see if people had, because the standard was to eat everything, not to leave anything in your bowl. And so then there was it was just, you know, and sometimes it was a senior monk who had some food left over, and then somebody, there's Ajahn Khan, look at that, which is, you know, it was really fun. It was just like people were taking it on, and yeah, it was a really proper standards, and then everybody was doing it, but then it wasn't in a like in a heavy way, but it was good. Like, yeah, even the senior monks had to. Okay, yeah, we can't leave any food.
Without labeling that, we can take a photo in there of everybody's bowl at hand and then post it up in the house. And this
Did I misunderstand at the beginning that the talk was originally given in Lao?
Yes, yes. That's actually Ajahn Chah's home language. The area that Ajahn Chah lived in spoke a Laotian dialect. So that it wasn't until after I first got there that he started speaking Thai more, because more Thai people were coming. I mean, it's close, but generally they can't understand each other. And but that would, when Ajahn Chah wanted to express himself, especially in something like this, then yeah, you would definitely go into your home language. And I can remember that talk. What kind of there? What is it? Kihai is like, yeah, it's disgusting. I was talking about the novices who were working at the boat, who drank, you know, multiple cups of coffee, and there was a Ajahn Chah person. Stop. I'm gonna puke. I can't take anymore. Listening to talks in Lao is when Lopo really could express himself fully. I mean, he was very good at expressing himself in Thai, when he was in the Lao language, then it's when it got really lively. I think there's a talk that it's in Bodhiana. I can't remember. Was it Two Faces of Reality? It's in that collection. That was from Lao, and I learned because I translated it, so I found it. I learned a lot of Lao just by translating that. And it was because I'd listened to the talk, and it was just everybody was enjoying it so much, and I could pick up about a quarter of what was going on. So I really want to know what he said. Going through that talk. There's also part of the in that story there is Ajahn Chah over time would mention Jaku Na many times, because I think it was Jokum Nogs, as I said, it was a royal page, somebody in 6 kings' service. So when he ordained, one of the things that he did was he wrote a list of a few things that he would have for his meal, I guess, like from his, probably from his family, I'm not quite sure, because he would have been from an influential family. He said, this is what I would like to eat. And it was, that's the meal that he ate for, I don't know, 30, 40, 50 years, however long he ordained. It was, that's what he ate. It was a, you know, quite a simple meal, balanced, and then, he never left the monastery, never really left his kuti that much, but he'd come out and do the morning, evening pujas. He had a very strong chanting voice, so I knew people who would go to Wat Thepsaraya to meditate and chant with the Jokum Nogam. And they said he had this very strong chanting voice and so this very strong presence, so that he inspired people for future generations. What Thepsaraya is really in it, it's right on the edge of Chinatown, between Chinatown and the old part of Bangkok. somewhat close to the railway station.
It said he slept in a coffin? Is that what it said in the talk?
I think he had a coffin in his room. I'm not sure he slept in it.
Yeah, that's what the... Yeah. Slept with... He had it in
his room. Yeah, had it in his room, yeah.
Was your experience for like 8 years living with novices? I mean, like that? Kind of like how I was describing it?
Well, it's not just novices. There was the novices, and then there's a range of the monks, the younger monks, I forget. they could be... that's how I learned Thai and novice from the novices, looking for something to do. So they had the time to chat with the Pharaoh. experience was up and down. But also, it was like the other side of the coin, you'll see with in June when they bring Ajahn Brichan back. He's somebody he came to Wat Bapong when he was 11 or 12 and came as an anagarika, was a novice with a vachana. Part of the sea of novices. There's a whole spectrum.
Was there like a cap put on the number of novices that were allowed to be in the monastery at one time? Or?
Not a cap. I mean, nothing was ever organized to that extent. But, Lopa was always attentive to the dynamics, and so that if for some reason, and he had lots of branch monasteries to sort of move people around with as well, like so he'd be moving people around from time to time. Something was the dynamics weren't weren't working somehow. So he'd pay attention to that.
Perception I get, I don't know where I got this, but from the introduction of the talk itself, is the monastery was sort of overrun, like an economic infestation.
No, not really. There would usually be, it's a big monastery. There'd be anywhere between, during the Pansa, then Dong Po would bring the numbers down to about 45, to get the numbers down, and then send people out. And then after Pansa, people would start coming. It used to be 65, 70, 75, 80. Monks and novices and Garkas in the monastery. It's quite a large community.
How did he communicate with his branch monasteries, and how often? With the head, with the abbots?
It would have to be physically. Either he would, either the monks would come to visit him, or he would go out to visit the monastery. There's no cell phones, couldn't Skype.
He was busy.
Hmm?
He was busy.
There's
a lot of movement in and out of the monastery.
Sometimes there were far away, and sometimes he would there'd be some kind of ceremony or something, so he could go and take a bunch of us with him. We got another responsibility of encouraging. In 1975, Wat Man Ong Chat is branch number 20, I think. And so then by the time he was from 75 through till the early 80s, and when he was, it'd be up, the branch number of branch monasteries was probably up to 45 or 50.
He probably wasn't a micromanager, was he?
No, not really. He paid attention to detail, just like that. I remember one talking to a monk and sort of saying that the way that Ajahn Chah used the branch monastery is because it was a part of the training of the senior monks. And it wasn't really give them encouragement, send them off, but then it's also he'd be paying attention to what that monk did, the difficulties or the problems that, how he dealt with the problems, how he created problems. And that would be his way of watching to be able to teach them. So he wasn't micromanaging and making them do everything. Certainly he was learning about those people from the way that they handled the situations that they were in.
Or I also get the impression from hearing the introduction to this talk that there was some element of that using the feedback and the behavior as a basis for pointing at the people's minds. Because, here, if we had a problem putting products, we would like organize it and make sure it never happened again. But there was more like just yell for a while and then we'd get better. And then when it started deteriorating again, you had maturity. Like it kind of Christopher Mill wasn't really, really interested in clean toilets. He was interested in helping people correct their defilements.
Yes, mostly. Mostly. But then if you help people correct their defilements, then the toilets actually do get clean.
Well, of course, there's this kind of like a constantly churning society, like people always coming and going.
Right.
Temporary ordination, novices. Yeah. There's always going to be a bunch of guys who just don't care.
yeah, totally. Yeah, they're very much the case. It's always so that you're always, on a certain level, it's a losing battle, which you recognize.
That raises a question I had, because I didn't think in Thailand there was... So some of these novices that he was talking to were temporary ordinations?
Oh, sure.
I didn't realize that was done in Thailand. I knew that only in Burma.
Oh, no. Thailand as well. Yeah. So the novice ordinations, bhikkhu ordinations, and then taking it on as a temporary thing.
How? What would be the duration of it? Was there a range, or was there?
Well, with Wakapong, then it would be with Wakapong, it would be far less more temporary, but it would be tentative, you know, in the sense that it wouldn't be just okay. Because Lumpa would rarely. There was a period where he accepted people for temporary ordination. And he did it a few times. Like when his mother died, then for the cremation, then, which I think was like 1976 or something, and she had been, I think she was about 80 or something when she passed away, and so he opened, because he hadn't accepted the people for a temporary ordination. So then he opened it up for people who wanted to take temporary ordination. And they ended up ordaining, I think, 80 people, according to her age. And people just came, and he ended up cutting it off. And, okay, we'll just do it as an honoring. Her age.
And they came in as samaneras or samaneras?
They would have a short period of anagarika, and if they were 20 years of age, then they would probably ordain directly as bhikkhus. And then there was a period, I think it was 3 years, where he decided to take on temporary ordinations, and then each year it was increasing numbers of people coming from all over the country. This was I can't remember, it was 78, 79, 80, or 79, 80, 81, something like that. And and then he just stopped that again. He said he started looking at the actual effect of that. He's saying, you know, you have 100 people ordained at the beginning of the Patsa, and then 130 just robe at the end. They're pulling people out of the monastery.
Because of the dirty toilet.
Yeah. just couldn't stand the dirty toilet. But in general, over the years, Paul was known to be quite kind of strict in terms of he wouldn't take people on just for a temporary ordination. It might be a tentative ordination in the sense of, you know, they would stick it out, they want to do it as meritorious for their family, for their mother. So it would be, you know, there's a fairly long training, a couple of years, and then, but they wouldn't be really sure they'd ordain, and they might stay for a couple of years, a couple of years, and so there was a definite sort of flux.
Have they ever done temporary ordinations at Wapananja?
He did temporary novice ordinations. I think Kabali is. quite sweet. They did it for the Bumwai villagers. Mm. And his little offices ordaining. And how many did he do? He's done it a couple times.
Yeah, the one I helped out with was the first one. Uh-huh. There was like 20 of them or something.
Uh-huh. That has an effect. But it had a big effect in terms of the relationship with the village. It's a very, very positive effect. I have done some temporary ordinations. Ajahn Siribanya, well, actually his first ordination was as a novice. That wasn't actually at Wat Namachan, but he ordained and then came to us, and it was arranged to do that. He actually ordained with Lopaput and then came and spent Patsa with us. it has been organized. Say like Eddie. Because he'd been around for quite some time. He's a close friend of Bunyu Wutong. He was the person who introduced Bunyu Wutong to Buddhism. So he'd been kind of close, and his very influential family in Bangkok. And so they had. So there's been temporary ordinations. Not a huge number. Far less than most other monasteries. It's a bit easier for us to kind of withstand the pressure.
Maurice Walsh? Maurice Walsh, did he do a temporary one in England? Or?
He did a temporary ordination in England. That was great. Morris was... he couldn't do that.
He wouldn't shave his eyebrows.
Because Morris Walter was the translator of the Deacon Nikaya, but he was a longtime supporter of the Dhammapatit, the place that became the Hampstead Vihara, and longtime Buddhist. He was a Oxford scholar, professor of German. He was his field of study was kind of the I can't remember that what it would be called, but it would be like 1400-1500 era of German literature. So he was a translator. Also translated Meister Eckhart. So he would have been 80, I think, or close to 80, and he really wanted to take a temporary ordination. And Ajahn Sumedho encouraged him, the whole community, because his house, his home was actually quite nearby. I think it's in Burkhardstedt. Which is like 4-5 kilometers.
Yeah. 3-4 miles.
Yeah, 3-4 miles from Amaravati. So that'd be a regular Pindabat route. Was Morris Walsh and stuff. Morris was every morning puja, every evening puja. He was right there.
How long did he stay in?
I think it was for a month. He did the Lhasa. Yeah, he was incredibly happy that he did it. That was very exceptional. And generally, we don't, but we take exceptions in certain circumstances.
We've had Ajahn Mahaprabhu service novices visit for a day. It's been fun sometimes.
I can't reach it.
They're trying to put food in their bowls.
Hello, How many other traditions in Thailand use the Anagarika model, the Anagarika novice speaker model?
Hardly any. Hardly any. I'm not sure what Sangatana does or not. I think they might. He really picked up Ajahn Chah's model of training. But I'm not sure. He's in his main monastery is on the outskirts of Bangkok, Durian Orchard. But I think he might have. It's a well-known group of monasteries. Ajahn Sanong. Interesting. Sort of a forest monastery with their own radio station, television station. Which is, nowadays, it's really common, actually. There's a support from the government to have these means of having things of public benefit. Okay, that's all right.